Well, good evening, everybody. You're all looking very peaceful. That's a nice thing, isn't it? Obviously, the Holy Spirit is here. It's been good. So we're going to continue in our discipleship theme that we've been walking through this weekend. And we kind of come to the difficult part this evening. But that's all right, because we've got a bit of time that we're going to spend later on to pray and to have an opportunity to be prayed for, to receive from the Holy Spirit. Because I guess it's inevitable, if we're thinking about our journey with Jesus and our walk with him, that at some point we're going to have to confront the fact that there might be mistakes and failures along the way. So we're going to think this evening about how we get past mistakes and failures that we might encounter, that we might do in our walk with the Lord and in our journey of following him. And I expect it's really the hardest part about being a follower of Jesus, isn't it? Is when it doesn't go right, when we fail. Maybe that could be failure in terms of things that we attempt for God. We're kind of hoping they're going to turn out a certain way and then they don't. And we feel that they've failed. That's sort of one aspect of these encounters. And then there's the aspect where we know we've let the Lord down personally in our own lives. You know, we've done things that are hurtful to him. We've done things that are not in his heart for us. And we make mistakes. We sin. And when we do those things, sometimes it can be hard to get past them. And I was thinking about Jesus' disciples that we read about, the 12. And actually, it's kind of encouraging when you look at them all, because there are some characters among the 12 that you don't really read very much about at all. Others that you kind of get a line or two or a word or two about their, and you sort of see, get little glimpses of their relationship with Jesus. And then others that we know much more about, like Peter and John and, you know, some of those famous ones. But I was thinking all the ones that are mentioned and have a little kind of word or two or an encounter with Jesus in there, it's usually based around something that they're getting wrong. And actually, in a way, that's quite encouraging for us this evening, because there is a way through when we get stuff wrong in our discipleship, in our journey with Jesus. There is a way through when we feel we've failed. There is a way through when we feel we've let the Lord down and how could he possibly ever use me again? There is a way through. I'm sure that all of the disciples encountered those times, not just the ones that we read about. But we're going to think about some of those a little bit in a moment. But first of all, I thought I'd kind of put it to us, because different personalities, and I don't know what your personality type is like here this evening, but different personalities respond and react quite differently to failure. Okay, and there's a myriad of ways, I'm sure, lots of things that we say to ourselves in response when something doesn't work out. So I'm going to challenge us to have a little bit of self-analysis for a moment and think about which type of person we are. I've got a few different responses here. So think about the last time, it's a bit miserable this, isn't it? But think about the last time that you either felt guilty about something, or you felt really discouraged about something. Yeah, one of those two kind of feelings. Think about the last time you felt guilty, the last time you felt discouraged. It might be the same time. And then think, how did you respond? What was the kind of thing that was going around in your head? Was it something like this? Well, it wasn't really my fault anyway. Yeah, some of us are the, it wasn't really my fault anyway. It was, if that person, this person and that person and that circumstance hadn't happened, well, we wouldn't be here. Maybe some of us are the, I'm just not going to think about it, people. Yeah, I'm just going to put that in a box and move on. That's other responses. Some of us are the, I am completely gobsmacked. People, we are astounded. We did not think that we could fail. And all of a sudden, we're completely dumbfounded. We can't believe that this has happened. Others are the opposite. Other responses go, well, typical, really, nothing ever works out for me. I wonder if there's some people like that in the room. Some people say, Well, I'll tell you what, I'm never doing that again. We say that to ourselves. I'm never doing that again. Some of us say, I'm just a failure. This just proves it. And some of us say, I give up altogether. You know, maybe it's a mixture of those things, but they're all very real and probably, if we're honest, really familiar responses to when we feel guilty, we feel like personally we've let ourselves down, we've let the Lord down. When we get something wrong, when something we're attempting or hoping is going to work out doesn't, they're very familiar sort of responses. And really, I suppose, all those different little phrases that might go round in our head, sometimes they're little mantras for our life, actually. Sometimes they're the kind of things that we're saying all the time. Every day we're kind of saying, well, it wasn't really my fault. Well, I'm just not going to think about that. Oh, you know, I can't believe this has happened. Oh, this always happens. You know, these things can sometimes be, like we talked about Jesus and his catchphrases earlier, these can be our little catchphrases. And the trouble with these responses to mistakes and failures is that it's really hard to get past them once you get locked into those cycles. And you are either just not facing up to the problem. Sometimes that means not facing up to ourselves because we're the problem. Or we're in a place where we've just got no hope and no faith that anything can change and be different in the future. And sometimes when we start to analyse our own hearts, we realise, actually, I'm in one of those places. There's something big that I'm just not facing. Or I've got absolutely no hope or faith that the future can be any different or any better. And it's because we've got into one of these responses and it's just gone round and round and we're sort of locked in. But the good news tonight is you don't stay locked in there forever. Not with Jesus. Jesus is the one who knows how to turn those negative responses that we often naturally have to mistakes and failures in our lives. He is able to turn them inside out. He's able to work even in them, even in our little mantras, even in our little catchphrases. Jesus is able to break right into the heart of that, into the very core of it, and start to unpick it and transform it, because he is the God who is the best at bringing things to birth out of completely barren situations, out of bringing forth the possible, out of the completely impossible, out of speaking light out of a dark situation, speaking life into deathly situations. He is the God who thrives on that kind of thing. So if you feel like, yeah, but this is just how I've always been, God is just, he's not put off by that. Jesus is the kind of God who is motivated by that kind of dry place in your life. He is motivated by the deserts in our lives, motivated by the locked in stuff and the bondages. He is the one who wants to come in and break them all open and set them all free and let life start to break forth. But it starts in a challenging place. And we looked at this on our first evening together. But I want to remind us of Jesus' definition of what a disciple really is. When he talked to his own disciples, this is what he said. If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. And really what Jesus is saying there is, we've got to die. I remember hearing someone say, I think it's quite a famous quote, so someone in the room probably knows who it was who originally said this. Some famous preacher sometime, a long time ago, said this brilliant phrase that gets repeated quite often. He said, we ought to be worried because the two most powerful beings in the universe are both seeking to kill you. That's how he started to preach once. I think it's some big American speaker. And he said, you know, the devil, he wants to kill you because he hates you. But God, he wants to kill you, not literally. But he wants to help you to die to yourself so that he can start to put his life in you. And then you really start to live. But it's quite an amusing thought, isn't it? The two most powerful beings. Satan obviously is less powerful than God, but, you know, he's got some power. They both are after you. So you may as well let God come and give you a cross and show you how to put your flesh to death on it and all the stuff that we are just naturally and in ourselves, all the mistakes, all the failures. We better let the Lord come and put those things on the cross with him, take them away, disempower them so that you can rise up into your new resurrection life just like he did all those years ago. That's the hope that we have to get past mistakes and failures. They end at the cross. And once we come to the cross with them, and once we take up our cross, and that's a bit of what that means, we're going to start to find freedom from the stuff that otherwise binds us up. I was remembering on our leadership training course called RadNet, Radical Network, that we run in Ichthus in London. We haven't run it for a couple of years now, but I remember a guy one year who came, and at the beginning of the year, we always got every person coming to train. It's sort of a training in leadership, training in theology and church planting and that kind of stuff. And at the beginning of the year, this guy came along from another nation, and on the first day, we always ask them, this is quite scary for some people, I think, who are not used to Ichthus-y type things that we do. But we always ask everybody to create, they've got a few hours in the afternoon, to create a prophetic statement from something. So we let them sort of wander around the house and the grounds where they'll be staying and living for that year. And they can just pick something up that sort of represents what they're asking God for the year, what they believe God has said to them about the year. So, you know, so you get different sorts of things. Like I remember on my year, one lady, she found like a bike chain somewhere, and she got the chain and she wrapped it around her hands, and her prophetic statement was, you know, Jesus wants to break off all the chains of the past from me this year, that kind of thing. And you know, people find all sorts of creative and wild and wacky ways of expressing their prophetic statement, but it's really powerful and it helps you remember them. That's why we ask them to do it. And this is why this one sticks in my mind, because there was a guy who went to the very bottom of the garden that year, and what he found was that there had been a bonfire there just burning away all kinds of stuff, and there was a big pile of ashes. And he picked up a big bowl of these ashes. And when he came back into the room, we all shared. And sometimes these times do get very personal. But he picked up this bowl and he put his hand in these black ashes. And he just let them fall through his hand like this. And he said, "This is like me." He said, "If I'm honest right now, I'm just a pile of ashes. I'm an ashes man," he said. He started to talk about the fact that he just felt like a complete failure in his ministry for God. He tried to plant a church and it had gone wrong, and some stuff had gone wrong, and people had got hurt, and it all finished and it all collapsed. And he felt, is God really still wanting to work with me, or am I just finished? Have I just completely messed up so badly there's no way back? And picked up these ashes and said, "That's me." But he said, "But I'm asking God to resurrect something for me from these ashes." And it was a powerful statement, and it was a powerful moment. Of course, we all piled in and really prayed for him. And the really lovely thing about that guy is that he's now the pastor of a very large church in another nation where he came from in the first place. He went back in the end, and the Lord is using him very, very powerfully and totally restored him from that place of ashes, because that is the kind of thing that Jesus wants to do with us in these times. So I want us to think a little bit this evening about some of the different disciples and the sorts of mistakes that they fell into in their walking with Jesus. Because for some of us, they might resonate a bit, and we might think to ourselves, "Yep, you know what? I've been there." Or we might think, "Well, actually, I could possibly go there in the future." Because the truth is, failure and mistakes is part of the discipleship process, whether we like it or not. All the disciples, perhaps we don't know about the ones we don't read about, but I'm pretty sure, all of the disciples, well, yes, they did, because we know that all of them fled, for example, on the night that Jesus was betrayed. And none of them stood with him to the end. They all failed. They all made mistakes. It's part of the journey. But the opportunity that Jesus has when we make those mistakes, when we find those moments of failure, is that we can say, "Lord, put it on the cross. Show me how to put it on the cross and resurrect me. Raise me up from the ashes again. I want to keep walking with you." And actually, far from being our moment of defeat, it can often be the first step before an incredible victory in the Lord, if we let him into it. And I want us to think about the sorts of mistakes that the disciples had to get past, because if they're anything like us, and I think they are, we'll probably have met them, or possibly in the future we'll encounter them. So the first pair, I'm going to take some of them together. I'm not doing all of them, but just a few. But the first little pair of disciples that we're going to analyse their mistakes. It's quite fun, isn't it, until we realise that we've done the same things. John chapter 6. And we're going to think about Philip and Andrew in this story. You don't necessarily have to follow along with me. You can if you want, jump, because I'll be jumping around a bit in the scriptures, but if you can keep up, you are welcome to. John chapter 6, I'm just going to read little snippets, little verses. Verses 5 to 9. Famous story. Therefore, Jesus, lifting up his eyes and seeing that a large crowd was coming to him, said to Philip, one of his disciples, "Where are we to buy bread, Philip, so that these may eat?" This Jesus was saying to test him, for he himself knew what he was intending to do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, or for everyone to receive a little. One of his disciples, another one, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are these for so many people?" And Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, in number about 5,000. Jesus took the loaves, having given thanks, he distributed to those who were seated, and likewise of the fish, as much as they wanted, and they were all filled. And you know the story so well. But in John's version, we get this insight. There's 2 disciples who come to the fore. There's Philip and there's Andrew. And both of them really kind of come with the same mistake. Perhaps Philip a little bit more so than Andrew, but I think depends how you read it. Depends about the tone of voice, doesn't it? But basically, both of them come with the same mistake. Here's their mistake. They totally underestimated Jesus. They were underestimating him. They hit a situation, and it says, it's important, I think, that John puts this detail in. He says, Jesus deliberately turned to Philip. It was a moment of testing. Okay, this was a moment. When we say testing, some of us have such a negative picture of that, and we think it's like God, like some big examiner in the sky, kind of like, "Oh, I want to give you crosses on your exam papers and tell you you're a failure." That's not the kind of testing we're talking about. Testing is opportunities, okay? And Jesus has got an opportunity here. He sees an opportunity for Philip and for Andrew and for all the disciples, if they want to get on board with it, to rise up in faith and to take a step on in their discipleship. This is their moment, yeah? This is their opportunity. And unfortunately, at the first hurdle, they kind of trip and fall. Not completely, because they get involved later on, and they are part of this amazing miracle that has always been in Jesus' heart, it says. He was always intending to do this. But at the beginning, he decides, let's see how much these guys think I can do. Let's see. And so he says to Philip, testing him, giving him an opportunity to show his faith, yeah? And he says, "How are we going to feed them?" And Philip's like, "Well, we haven't got any money, and there's nowhere to buy anything, and we wouldn't have enough even if we did have enough money." And he's looking at all the sort of practical, financial, physical circumstances. In some ways, that's not wrong, is it? It's not a terrible thing to do. But underneath it all, there's this big mistake that we so often make. And I think, I imagine Jesus' heart a little bit sinking, especially when, you know, we know from the Gospels, don't we, that there's another incident not too much further on where Jesus feeds not 5, but 4,000 people. Do you remember this one? And he's kind of asking them the same questions. "Oh, can we do it? What should we do?" And the disciples all give the same answers. They're all like, "No, we'll never do it. It's too big a crowd. Send them away." And at that point, you see Jesus, you know, his frustration comes out a little bit, doesn't he? He's like, "Oh, can't you even remember? I've just done it with 5,000. This is a smaller crowd. We can do this. Come on, guys. Where's your faith?" And he's surprised that they haven't learnt yet. And I think this is the thing that Jesus is saying, don't underestimate me. It's a big mistake. And the thing is, you can always live in that place of the limited Jesus, the Jesus who can only do stuff with the money you've got and the opportunities you've got and the abilities you've got and the gifts you've got and the opportunities that are ahead of you. The Jesus who can only do stuff with that and nothing more. Well, that's a limited place to be, and actually that's not a place of faith, and we'll miss, the sad thing is, potentially we will miss, if we live in that place, the incredible, beautiful, feeding miracles that Jesus wants to do with us and through us. He wants to touch more lives beyond you and your life than you are even slightly aware of. Philip was concerned about his own resources, his own ways of thinking. You know, Andrew maybe had a little bit more faith. He's like, well, there's something here. But then he's like, oh, yeah, but it's not possibly going to be enough. You know, he starts to dare. And then he's like, oh, no. Maybe we'll see what Jesus got to do with it, you know. But Jesus is encouraging his disciples here to step beyond that and to see him as all-powerful, as able to do so much more than we can possibly think or imagine. Because if we live in that place, then we're going to start to be used by him to feed thousands of people with the goodness of God. And you know what? There's a lot of spiritually hungry people around your life and around my life who are desperate for us to step up and stop underestimating Jesus so they can get fed and they can come to know him and they can be filled up with his life too, you know? And yet we're the ones who are like, oh, I couldn't possibly. Oh, no, Jesus couldn't use me. Oh, no, if I try and do that, it's all going to go wrong. You know, we're those people. And Jesus is saying, don't underestimate me. Step beyond. Next one. I'm going to race through these quickly. Next pair, if you like, that we're going to look at. Another little mistake. James and John. This time, little mistake. Maybe this one's not so little, I don't know. Let's read a few words from Mark chapter 10. Verse 35 says this. James and John, the two sons of Zebedee, came up to Jesus saying, Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. Classic, hey? We want you to, and how many prayers do we pray that are basically that? Yeah. We want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. And he said to them, what do you want me to do for you? And they said to him, grant that we may sit one on your right and one on your left in your glory. But Jesus said to them, you do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized? And they said to him, we are able. And Jesus said to them, the cup that I drink you shall drink. And you shall be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized. But to sit on my right or on my left, this is not mine to give. It's for those for whom it has been prepared. Hearing this, the ten began to feel indignant with James and John, unsurprisingly. And so calling them to himself, Jesus said to them, you know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. And their great men exercise authority over them. But it is not this way among you. Whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. What was their mistake, James and John? Well, I guess, you know, the flip side, really, underestimating Jesus, overestimating themselves. That's what James and John were doing. They were overestimating themselves. They were thinking to themselves, you know, we're kind of the most important disciples around here, it seems to me. You know, we do most of the stuff with Jesus. We get in on the inner circle with Jesus, and he's always wanting to call us on every mission trip that we go on, and we're his right-hand men. And I think that needs to be recognized now by the others. So if Jesus could just describe the seating plan for heaven and explain that we'll be on the top table, you know, right there, either side of of Jesus there. Everyone can see how important we were, and we'll get the recognition that we deserve. And the rest of these disciples, who are very insubordinate and always trying to tell us what to do, they'll start learning their place. And, you know, you can hear the attitude, can't you, coming out in them. And in some ways we can laugh at it because it's a bit outrageous. And in other ways, it's very, very close to home. Because the truth is that even if you don't go around saying that kind of stuff, most of us in our hearts at some point or another have thought to ourselves, I'm not getting recognized in the way that I deserve to. Think about all those amazing things I did. Look at the way that I did that, this, that and the other. Look at how long I've been on this serving team and been doing this, and no one ever tells me how great I am about it. And nobody ever gave me a bunch of flowers at the front of church when I did something amazing, and nobody ever called me up and said thanks when I did this. You know, those type of things, they're very familiar, aren't they? And it's the same thing. It's the same. What we're saying is we need a bit more recognition, Jesus, because we've done some pretty great stuff for you. And it is a trap of discipleship. It is a trap that we can fall into as we walk with Jesus. But the sad thing is, if we don't spot it, if we don't recognize it, if we don't move past it, we will all encounter that. But what are we going to do when those feelings start to rise up and arise? Are we going to let them take over? Are we going to live in that place? Because if we do, well, Jesus didn't let James and John do that. He said to them, you know what? You are going to walk a hard road. You are going to drink my cup. You are going to suffer my sufferings. And they did. They did. They were put to death at the end of their lives for their testimony to Jesus. And Jesus knew that. He knew that they would get there in the end. But he was calling them on, look, get past this and learn to be a servant. Because if you don't, you risk missing out on the incredible ways that I want to use you. And think, you know, years and years and years later, these men, some of the most famous men in the world, James and John, early church founders, people who wrote letters to God's people and encouraged them. And we still read them today and find God's Spirit moving through us, like, because these guys didn't stay in that place of just overestimating themselves and feeling miffed because they weren't recognized in the way they should have been, but they managed to get to a place where they got on their knees and served. And we don't want to fall down at this hurdle. We want to recognize it's something we will encounter, but we can go through with Jesus. We can move through and find that place of servanthood again. The place that says, I don't mind taking last place. I don't mind not jostling for first place. I'm happy to serve in his kingdom. Because that's the best place to be anyway. Then you've got somebody like Nathanael, or Bartholomew is his other name. Bit confusing. Everyone in the Bible's got about six different names that they use, don't they? And that makes it much more confusing. But Nathanael, as we'll read about him in John chapter 1. Now, his mistake, if you like, is right at the very beginning of his journey with Jesus. But I think this is quite a key one. And probably it matters that it was the beginning. John chapter 1, this is what we read about Nathanael in verse 45. This is all to do with when the disciples were first being called by Jesus. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, we have found Jesus, we found him, of whom Moses wrote in the law and also the prophets, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. And Nathanael said to him, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? And Philip said to him, come and see. Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and said to him, behold, an Israelite in whom there is no deceit. Nathanael said to him, how do you know me? And Jesus answered and said to him, before Philip called you when you were under the fig tree, I saw you. Nathanael answered him, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. Jesus answered and said, because I said this to you, that I saw you under the fig tree, you believe? You will see greater things than these. Truly I say to you, you will see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. I love this response of Nathanael, Bartholomew, because it's just so true. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth, he said. He's not just being kind of a bit racist or something. He himself comes from Nazareth. Okay, this is his hometown. This is where Jesus is calling these guys. Nathanael is locked into this negative perspective of his own identity. And this is a big problem for disciples. It's a big problem if we stay there. If we hit that mistake and we stay in it. Because Jesus doesn't seem very concerned about where we come from, our origins, our background, the opportunities that we did have or we didn't have, how great our parents were, how brilliant our education was, how much people think that the town we came from is a great town or a terrible town, whether it was full of crime, whether it was full of beauty. You know, Jesus isn't so bothered about that stuff, but we get hugely bothered and we define ourselves so much by our origins and our environment. We find our identity in, you know, well, I come from that place, so that makes me like this, you know. I remember when I first started working with the Youth and Schools Work Project, XLP, and Patrick Regan, who lots of you might have met or heard of or come across, but remember when I first met him, he talked about the reason he started this Youth and Schools Project in Peckham was because he lived in Peckham himself, and every time he said to people, oh, I live in Peckham, they were always like, oh, Peckham, oh, in South East London, you know? And there are places like that, aren't there, around the world. This was one of them. Nazareth is one of them. That's why Nathanael said, oh, nothing good can come out of there, can it? And I remember Patrick saying it just spurred him on. You know, people thought Peckham was a place of trouble, and he was like, no, I want it to be a place full of hope and where the glory of God can be seen breaking out in people's lives. And, you know, he got a vision from God about that. But we can so easily get locked into a particular identity that's like, well, I come from this, and so nothing really can be any different, and this defines me, and this is my realm, and this is who I am, and bad things happen, and it's miserable, and it's not successful, and it is just a failure all the time, and we get locked into this thing, and Jesus wants to break us free from our fleshly identity, whoever we are. Because equally, you might be the sort of person who's like, yeah, but look at my amazing heritage, you know, and look, I've got Christians that span. Somebody told me recently, actually, there's a guy who's just joined our church. He's not like this, by the way, the negative side. But there's a guy who's just joined our church recently who can trace his ancestors through his family back to the very first missionaries who came to the area he lives in. He grew up in a small area in South America somewhere. And he knows who the missionaries were who first came there, and he knows the person who got saved, and then their son, and then their son, and their son, so on, passed down. And so he knows he's got a whole generation since the gospel first ever came to that village. His family were the first in, you know? And he's actually a great guy. He's not proud about that. But, you know, even if you're that sort of person, and you think, so I've got everything going for me, and I've had Christians down my heritage, and I've had all sorts of opportunities, and I've been to Bible college, and I don't know what else. You know, all the stuff we think is good and makes us somebody important in God's kingdom. And that stuff too, Jesus is like, hang on, I don't see you as that. Okay, I see you in this moment, Jesus says. I'm speaking to you, what are you going to do? How are you going to respond? That's what matters. Not what your history says, not what your passport says, not what your birth certificate says. This moment is what matters. I'm standing in front of you, says Jesus, whoever you think you are and wherever you think you come from, do you want to come somewhere with me? We're going to see beautiful things. We're going to see angels coming and going in the heavenly places. We're going to see Jesus lifted up as the Son of Man. We're going to see glorious things that God wants to show us if we can let go of that stuff that otherwise we define ourselves by. Just a couple more before we take time to pray together. Thomas, he's another one. Now, he's a famous one and often we think that his mistake is doubting. He's known, isn't he, as Doubting Thomas. And you know, I think that's part of it, but I want to emphasize something else. I'll just read the few words around it. John chapter 20, verse 24. But Thomas, one of the 12, called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came in the resurrection, this is. He wasn't there the first time Jesus appeared. So the other disciples were saying to him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see in his hands the imprint of the nails and put my finger into the place of the nails and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." After 8 days, his disciples were again inside and Thomas with them. Jesus came, the doors having been shut, and stood in their midst and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Reach here with your finger and see my hands, and reach here your hand and put it into my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing." And Thomas answered and said to him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Because you have seen me, have you believed? Blessed are they who did not see and yet believed." Sometimes we feel a bit sorry for Thomas, don't we? Because we're all about the proof, especially in our Western world, aren't we? We like there to be kind of, you know, physical evidence. And I think that's right. I don't think that's the only thing that Jesus is challenging here for Thomas. I think part of it is the fact, and perhaps this is a bit that gets lost when we tell the story because we're so used to thinking of him as doubting Thomas. But I think what Jesus is getting at here, first and foremost, is, Thomas, why couldn't you receive the truth when it came from the other disciples that I am alive? Why couldn't you receive it from someone else? His response is, "I have to know for myself." Yeah, I have to find out without being told. Okay, that's the kind of response he makes. He could have said, couldn't he? He could have said, his response could have been, when they said, "We've seen the Lord," he could have been like, "Wow, that's really interesting. Jesus did say that he would rise from the dead, didn't he? Could this really be true? Perhaps I'll only fully believe if I put my fingers in his hands," you know. But he doesn't say that, does he? He's like, "I'm not going to take it on your word, guys. I need to be there myself. I need to find it out. I need to be the master of my own discovery." And there's something, I think, in that attitude that Jesus is trying to get at. I don't think it's to do with, I mean, that's why Jesus is so gracious, isn't he? He allows him. He says, you know, "Come on, put your hands in my wounds." It's not that that was a wrong thing to ask on its own. It's that lying behind it, I think, comes this desire that I'm just not going to let other people speak into my life about the truths of God. I kind of have to find it all myself. This sort of independent finding our way. And the thing about the journey of a disciple is it's not independent. You see, when Jesus called those guys, they were individuals, but he called them together, the 12 of them. And what they had to do, the mission that he gave them, was a together mission, yeah? And they needed to learn right in that moment. Thomas, it was so important to Jesus. You've got to learn this, Thomas. You've got to learn that you can't just do everything like some lone ranger. You know, because I don't really trust anybody else, only me. You know, that attitude doesn't move you on in discipleship. You've got to trust. You've got to invest your life with these people. You've got to let them in. You've got to let them tell you sometimes stuff that you weren't there for, you know, and you've got to receive it and let it in. And we find that really tough, don't we? Because lots of us, we're quite independent people. And perhaps lots of us have grown up in ways where we've sort of had to fend for ourselves and kind of look after number one. And, you know, there's been no one else to look out for me. So it's just me. And when you've had those kind of experiences, sometimes we carry that over into our Christian lives. But the thing is, it trips us up. It's a mistake. It goes wrong when we try and live out of that. You know, stuff goes wrong and we don't receive the fullness of what God wants to do in our lives. We don't receive the fullness of his blessing and the fullness of his grace and his mercy and his goodness because we're not letting anyone else ever speak into our journey. And Thomas should have let them. He should have let them say, "We saw Jesus," and he should have just opened the door just a little bit even at that point. "Really? Wow, that would be amazing. I don't know if I can believe it yet." You know, that's a very different response. But he didn't. The door was shut in his heart. "No, no, I've got to know for myself." And I think we can do that with one another. And Jesus is calling us, saying, "As my disciples, learn how to trust one another and to let each other speak into your life, to let people tell you, to receive from teaching to receive from people's prayers, to receive from people's love even. Sometimes we don't even want to receive help and encouragement and love for people because we sort of think we've got to find it all for ourselves. And Jesus is calling us and saying, don't get locked in that place, because you'll end up not fully being able to complete the mission that I've got for you. If Thomas was going to be a Lone Ranger, he wasn't going to be able to be that apostle to the world that actually he ended up being. And this is the last pair that I want us to think about just for a couple of minutes before we pray tonight. And it's the famous ones. Simon Peter and Judas Iscariot. Because we see in them perhaps two of the biggest failure moments, don't we? At the key moment of Jesus' life, the key moment of his ministry, we have Peter who denies him, curses and swears, says he's never met the man. You know, it's not even like he just ran away. That's the thing about Peter. He was there, and then he disowned Jesus publicly. Gosh, that's hard. That must have been hard to live with, mustn't it? He was close to Jesus. He was close. And Judas, well, we know how hard it was for him. There's a moment, it says, doesn't it, in John's Gospel, where Satan enters in, hardens his heart, I suppose, and he's sort of stuck on this road. He doesn't feel he can ever get off now. And he betrays Jesus for those 30 pieces of silver. And I was thinking about those two. What were their mistakes? What was it? What's kind of underneath it all? Well, for Peter, I suppose, you know, he makes this amazing protestation, doesn't he, before Jesus is just about to go to Gethsemane. And Peter's like, you know, can we go with you, Lord, to the cross? He didn't really know what he was asking. And Jesus is like, no, you can't follow me. And Peter's like, well, why can't I follow you? I'll follow you anywhere, Jesus. I'll die for you. Remember? And it's just a few hours later that he runs away, and then he comes and in front of everyone says, no, I don't know him, because he's too afraid of what might happen. And Jesus is so wonderful, isn't he? Because he sees in Peter the heart that wants to be someone that he isn't yet. And I think Peter's problem, maybe, underneath it all, is that he was kind of running ahead of himself. Because actually, Peter was going to be that person who did, in the future, like all of the rest of them, lay his life down for the sake of Jesus and for his gospel. He was going to get there, but he wasn't there yet. So he was sort of running ahead of himself. And I think, as disciples, we can do that. Because, you know, the Lord plants things in our hearts that are for the future, and we think, yeah, right now, I'm ready for that, you know? We get really excited about it, and we jump on board, and we grab hold of it, and we try and do it and live it, and actually, Jesus is kind of saying to us, not yet, sometimes. Not yet. Not yet. And it must have been really hard, I think, for Peter to face up to the realities of who he really is. Yeah, it must have been hard for him to face up to the fact that he wasn't the person he thought he was for Jesus. Anyone ever had that experience? Well, you thought you were somebody. You thought you were a really great Christian. And it turned out you weren't, yeah? Anyone ever had that? I know I have. And actually, that is a hard place to get past. Facing up to the reality of ourselves, because we kind of want to believe that we are the people that we want to be for Jesus, just on our own. And Jesus has to teach us sometimes, and that's why this is such an important lesson. He has to teach us to face the facts that we fail, that we're weak, that we're cowardly. For Peter, he had to face the fact, I'm a coward. I care more about myself than I do about Jesus and his purposes. He had to face that fact. It was true. Even about Peter, great Peter, the great apostle to the church, the great prince of the apostles, as they call him later. Even Peter had to look at himself and recognize, you know what? I'm not that great. and I can't do all that much for the Lord. But he managed to get through. He got through that place. And I think there's a difference, because Judas doesn't, does he? Because in a way, Judas's problem is not that different. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Judas, we know his love of money and probably his desire for position and his desire to kind of be somebody and for Jesus to accomplish something that he was hoping Jesus would accomplish. All of that stuff was more important to him than who Jesus actually was. You know, he loved those things more than he loved Jesus. But Judas couldn't get past that mistake. He has an opportunity, doesn't he? At the supper, when Jesus says, someone here is going to betray me. And there's a moment, and they're all saying, is it me? Is it me? Is it me? And Jesus dips the bread, doesn't he, in the wine. And he offers it to Judas. And he looks Judas in the eye. And he's got an opportunity. He said, you're going to betray me, basically. You're going to betray me. Are you? Now, at that moment, the deed was kind of already done, wasn't it? Judas had already been out, had his little word with the high priests, told them that he was going to tip them off when he got an opportunity. It was all in place. The plan was in place. But there was a moment there, I was thinking about this, where Judas could have said to Jesus, Jesus, I'm sorry. I've done a terrible thing. You're right. I've betrayed you. I've told the authorities where to find you, or I've said that I will do, and they're going to come for you, and they're going to arrest you, and they're going to try and put you to death, and I'm sorry, I don't know why I did it, what got into me. You know, he had this moment, and I often wonder when I look back at it, and I think if Judas had taken that opportunity, things would probably have still gone down pretty much the same way, but he could have been one of them. He could have stayed, maybe, one of the disciples. You know, he could have stayed alongside. Because Jesus forgives. He forgave Peter. He restored Peter. And I think he wouldn't have offered that moment of friendship to Judas if it wasn't a real possibility, a real chance for him to say, Jesus, actually, I do want friendship with you more than I want the money and the fame and the whatever else that I was looking for. I do want that, really. He was appealing, wasn't he, to everything in Judas that was saying, I want to be a better man. But for Judas, he couldn't get past it. He'd already done it. And it was so miserable that we know that he went out from that place when he sees Jesus get arrested and he knows he's going to be crucified, and he goes off and he hangs himself. He can't get past it. And he loses his inheritance as one of the disciples of Jesus. He loses it. He forfeits that place. And there's a difference there between Judas and Peter. And do you know what I think the difference comes down to? Comes down to where the response that Peter had, the response that Judas had when Jesus looked them in the eye. Because we know, don't we, that warming his hands at the fire, Peter cursing and swearing, I didn't know the man. It says he looked and there was an open doorway and he could see right through. He could see Jesus' face looking at him and made eye contact. And in that moment, Peter wept and everything in his heart melted. But instead of saying, it's all over, I've lost it, he saw in that face sorrow, love flowing mingled down, like the song says. He saw acceptance, forgiveness, a hope that he could still be the man that he really wanted to be. He saw it all there in Jesus' eyes in that moment, in that look. And it moved him through. Judas, well, I think he didn't stay looking at Jesus for long enough. Because he probably thought he knew what he would see there if he looked in Jesus' eyes. What would he expect to see? He'd expect to see a lot of anger, disappointment, betrayal. I give up on you. Can't believe you would do this to me. Think about all we've been through together, Judas. He's expecting to see all of that, isn't he? But I think if he'd looked, surely he'd have seen what Peter saw. The love, the forgiveness, the hope for a future. And that's what meant that on that walk on the beach a few days later with Jesus in the resurrection, Peter could say, "You know that I love you. I do love you, Jesus. I want to be better. I want to be better than all of that, my past. I want to move on. I want to fulfill the calling you've got for my life." But we've got to look in his eyes. And I want to finish with this, because I remember, for me, a key moment in my life when I knew I'd let the Lord down. I just behaved in a way that was just not in keeping with his character. And I was so ashamed of myself. And I felt like, how could the Lord ever use me again? I've just made so many mistakes. And my testimony of what it means to be a Christian is just all shot to pieces. And it's just rubbish now. And how can I get back from that? And I felt such a failure inside. And I remember what it did to me was I started to shut down. And I think this is the danger. And I think this is what must have happened to Judas as the guilt kind of set in. And I kept thinking, you know, I don't really want to pray. And I don't really want to worship because I kind of know what he's going to say. You know, I know what God's going to say to me. He's going to tell me off. Tell me what, you know, failure I've been. Tell me how rubbish I am. Tell me how he can't believe that after all this time I'm still making these mistakes. You know, I had all of that in my head because that's actually what I was saying to myself. And I just, you know, I went to church, I did all the right things, but inside I was shut down. You know, some of you know what I'm talking about. Maybe you've been there. And I wasn't really looking at him. You know, I was worshipping, "Oh Lord, you know, I love you." But in my heart, I was somewhere miles away. And I remember there was this moment in a worship meeting, and I was at the back and I was all shut down inside. And suddenly the Lord just spoke into it so clearly. And he just said, "Debbie, just look at my face. Look at me." And I thought, oh, I don't know what that means. But I kind of closed my eyes and I tried to imagine the face of Jesus. And as I tried to imagine it, I honestly tried to sort of imagine it with this disappointed, grieved kind of look. And I pictured his face and I looked in those eyes and I just didn't see any of that there. I just saw, what I saw in Jesus' eyes was relief. Relief, like he was saying to me, "Finally, you're going to look at me. Finally, you're coming back. Finally, you trust me. Finally, we can find a way through this. Finally, there's a future and a hope with us together." And in that moment, just the love and the hope that I saw, I thought it must have been something like that, that Peter saw in those eyes. And I think as disciples, we've got to hit those moments and we've got to take them so that we get through our own failures, our own mistakes, that we come out the other side and we live as the people that God wants us to be. Judas didn't do it, didn't look for long enough. Peter did, and there was restoration and a future serving the Lord ahead of him. And I want us just to pray this evening. As we finish, we've got a few minutes left before our drinks come out. And I'd love us just to pray because, you know, maybe some of those different mistakes that we've been talking about, maybe there are places where we've been there. And maybe there's one in particular that you're kind of like, yeah, you know what, Lord, I can get stuck in that place. And he doesn't want us to get stuck. He wants us to see him afresh this evening. And I wonder if the way we can pray tonight is, I wonder if someone would mind leading just a song of worship to Jesus as we close. Is that all right in a moment? And as we worship together, if you would like someone just to come alongside and pray with you, maybe there's a mistake or a failure or something you're feeling like you can't get past, and you just want someone to pray the beauty of that face, the beauty of that look in Jesus' eye over you, then you can just indicate, maybe just put your hands out in front of you or give a little wave. And I'll just come round, and maybe there are some others who want to pray as well, I don't know. But I'll just come round, and we want to take time. But the rest of us, if you don't want to specifically respond tonight, why don't we just take the opportunity to look in Jesus' face as we worship together for these last few minutes. Just look at him. Make that eye contact and hear what he's got to say to you. Is that all right? So I'm going to let Kevin, is it, lead us just in a song of worship or a couple of songs to give us an opportunity to pray. And if people want, as we, you know, we'll kind of close the meeting, but afterwards, if you want to stay, if you want to pray further about anything in particular, then of course there's always an opportunity to do that. But I'm just going to move around as we worship. Maybe we want to stand. Let's respond to the Lord. And I'll move around. And if you'd like me to pray for you, just nod or grab me, all right?